fire so the glue would melt. Meanwhile, she went through the dozen or so branches that looked to be good handle material and picked out the two best. Once the glue was ready, she showed Chris where to drill holes in the branches and how to taper the end that was going to be fastened to the blade. Her wrists just weren't strong enough for the job. When he finished the first one, she lashed it to the blade with wet rawhide, stretching the thong as tightly as she could so that it would shrink and bind the shovel to blade as firmly as possible when it dried. Then she cross-braced the back of the blade with a smaller branch cut to fit, lashing it the same way to the handle. Lastly, she glued the piece of frame to the back of the shovel blade to act as a stop to keep the snow from sliding off. She lashed another piece of branch to the handle behind the stop to act as a brace. Then she glued every join on the whole makeshift shovel, saturating even the rawhide with glue. That finished all she knew how to do. She set the whole thing aside to cure overnight and started in on the second.
"They are not going to hold up under much rough handling," she sighed wearily when she'd finished. "We're going to have to treat them with a great deal of care."
"It's better than trying to do it with bare hands," Chris replied,
taking her hands in his own and massaging them.
"I guess so."
She tried to force herself to relax.
"Chris, just how does the guard clear the roads off?"
"They recruit villagers. Then it's teams with shovels. They dig out the worst places and pack down the rest."
"I don't imagine that it's a very fast process."
"No."
The single word hung in the air between them. Talia was afraid, but didn't want to put more of a burden on Chris than he already had by giving way to her fears. The silence between them grew.
"I hate to say this," he broke it reluctantly, "but you're projecting. I can feel it, and I know it isn't me, and Tantris just backed me up."
Anger flared a little, followed by despair.
"Damn it, Talia, lock it down! You're not helping either of us."
She gulped back a sob, bit her lip hard enough to draw blood, then steadied herself by beginning a breathing exercise. It calmed her, enough that she actually found the leakage and blocked it. Chris heaved a sigh of relief and smiled at her, and she felt a tiny stirring of hope and accomplishment. Finally, he let her hands go and went after the harp. She wasn't in a mood to sing by any means, but he chose nothing that she knew. He seemed more to be drifting from melody to melody, perhaps finding his own release from distress in the music he searched. She listened only. The churras seemed to have caught the somber mood and did not sing either. She used the harp song to reinforce her own ritual of calming and did not open her eyes until it stopped. Chris had risen and was replacing the harp in its corner of the hearth. He returned to her side and stretched himself next to her without speaking. She was the one who broke the silence.
"Chris, I'm scared. Really afraid. Not just because of what's happening to me, but because of all that," she waved her hand, "out there."
"I know."
A pause.
"I'm scared, too. We haven't got a good situation here. You could have killed us both the other night. You still could. And out there, I've never felt so helpless in my life. Between the two, I just wanted to give up. I just wanted to curl up in a ball and hope it all went away."
It cost him to admit that, Talia knew.
"I wish I wasn't so messed up. I wish I was bigger and stronger. Or a fire speaker like Kittle,"
she replied in a very small voice.
"You can't help what happened. As for being a fire speaker, I don't think both of us together could reach someone with the gift to hear us, and if we could, I don't know that it would do any good."
He sighed.
"We just have to keep on as we have been and hope we get out of here before the supplies run out. That's the real problem, when it comes down to it, the supplies. Otherwise, I wouldn't worry. We've got about enough for a month, but not much more than that. If we run out..."
"Chris, you know we are in Soros. Remember the tree? Maybe we'll be sent game."
"You could be right," he mused, beginning to brighten. "It would take less magic to send a few rabbits within reach of our bows than it did to divert that tree."
"And maybe we'll get out before we have to worry about it.
And you don't have to worry about me. You know, I'm border bred. I can do with a lot less than I've been used to eating.
Let's not cut rations down unless we have to. We'll be using a lot of energy keeping warm.
Gloom settled back over them. Talia decided that it was her turn to dispel it.
I wonder what things are like back at court right now. It's almost midwinter.
Pandemonium. It's never less. Uncle hates midwinter. There are so many people coming in for the celebrations who just incidentally have petitions that there are council meetings nearly every day.
She looked at him unhappily. I don't get along with your uncle very well.
No, that's a lie. I don't get along with him at all. I know he doesn't like me. But there's more to it than that. I keep having the feeling that he's looking for a way to get rid of me.
Chris looked flatly astonished.
Whoa! Wait just a minute here. You'd better start at the very beginning. I can hardly believe my ears.
All right, she replied hesitantly, but only if you promise to hear me out completely.
That's only fair, I guess.
All right. When I first got to the Collegium, I had a pretty miserable time of it, as you know. Dirty tricks, nasty anonymous notes, ambushes. It was the unaffiliated students, the Blues, but they made it seem as if it was other trainees that might be responsible, so I wouldn't look inside the Collegium for help. It all came to a head.
When they dumped you in the river just after midwinter.
And they meant to kill me.
What?
He exclaimed.
It isn't common knowledge. Elkarth and Kirill know, and Cheryl, Karen, Skiff, Taryn, and Jerry. Ilsa knew, so did Jadis. I think Albrecht knows, Miro guessed. I'm pretty sure one or more of the others told Selene sometime later. One of the Blues told me to give their greetings to Talamir just after they threw me in. I think the meaning there is pretty clear. They expected me to drown, and if it hadn't been that my bond with Roland was strong enough for him to know what had happened. Well, but I was delirious with fever when they were caught, and I couldn't tell anyone. They claimed it was all just a joke, that they hadn't thought I'd get worse than a ducking. Your uncle backed them up before the council. So instead of being charged with trying to kill me, they got their wrists slapped and were sent home to the familial bosoms.
That's hardly an indication that
you promised not to interrupt me.
Sorry.
The next time we got into it was over Skef. It was right when Skef was helping me unmask Elspeth's nurse, Holma. I needed to find out who had sponsored her into Valdemar besides Selene and Elspeth's father. Skef went to the provost marshal's office to find the immigration records, and Orthalin caught him there. He dragged him up in front of Selene, accusing him of trying to alter the misdemeanor book. And he demanded that Skiff be given the maximum punishment for it, stable duty with the guard for the next 2 years on the border. You know what that could have meant. At worst, he could have been killed. At best, he'd be 2 years behind the rest of us, and I'd have been without one of my two best friends all that time, as well as being without the only person in the Collegium who could possibly have helped me expose Holda. I got Skiff off, but I had to lie to do it, and I can tell you that Orthalin was not pleased. Chris looked as if he wanted to interject something, but held his peace. Lastly, there's the matter of my internship. Orthalin, in view of my youth and inexperience, was trying to pressure the council into ruling I should stay out in the field for 3 years, double the normal time. Fortunately, neither Selene nor Elkarth nor Kirill were having any of that, and pointed out that internships are subject only to the will of the Circle, not the Council.
Is that all?
Isn't it enough?
Talia, this all has very logical explanations, if you know my uncle. Firstly, he couldn't possibly have known about the students' malice. I'm certain of it. He's known most of them since they were in swaddling clothes. He even refers to people grown and with babes of their own as the youngsters, and he probably felt obligated to act as their spokesperson. After all, you had two people to speak for you on the council, Elkarth and Kirill.
I suppose that's logical, Talia said reluctantly. But Skiff, oh, Skiff,
my uncle is a prude, and a stickler for convention. I know that for a fact. Skiff has been a thorn in his side ever since he was chosen. Before Skiff came, there was never any problem with heraldic students getting involved in trouble down in town. The unaffiliates and the bardics, and once in a great while the healers, but never the greys.
Never?
Talia's right eyebrow rose markedly. I find that rather hard to believe. Well, almost never. But after Skiff started his little escapades, Lord and Lady, the Greys are as bad as the Bardics. It's like the younger ones feel they have to top him. Well, Uncle is not amused, not at all. He's a great believer in military discipline as a cure for high spirits, and I'm certain he never meant anything worse for Skiff than that.
What about me? Why does he keep trying to get between me and Selene?
He's not. You are young. His idea of Queen's Own is someone like Talamir. I have no doubt he truly felt a long internship was appropriate in your case.
I wish I could believe you.
Holding a grudge is rather childish and unlike you.
I am not holding a grudge.
Then why are you even refusing to consider what I've told you?
Talia drew a deep breath and forced herself to calm down.
There is a third explanation for what he's been doing. It could be that he thinks of me as a threat to his influence with Selene. And I might point out one other thing to you, and that is, I am willing to bet the person who told you all about those rumors is your uncle, and I'd be willing to bet he asked you to investigate them. He knows what my gift is. He could well know what the effect of hearing that poison would be on me.
Instead of refuting her immediately, Chris looked thoughtful.
That is a possibility. At least over the internship thing. He's very fond of power, my uncle. He's been Selene's chief advisor for a long time and was her father's before that. And there isn't a great deal you can do to change the fact that Queen's Own is always going to have more influence than chief advisor. And I hate to admit it, he finished reluctantly, but you're right about my source of information on the rumors.
Talia figured that now that she'd got him thinking instead of just reacting, it was time to change the subject. She would dearly have loved to have suggested that Orthalin might well have originated the rumors, but Chris would never have stood still for the implication that his uncle's conduct was less than honorable.
Chris, let's try and forget about it for a few hours anyway. We've got other things to worry about.
He regarded her soberly.
Like the fact that you had enough energy to project. Like the fact that you could do it again.
Yes. She drew a deep breath. I could even break down again. I was right on the verge of it this afternoon. If we hadn't had something to do, I might have. And I was maybe hallucinating out there.
Hell.
I'll try. But I thought you'd better be warned.
Featherfoot?
He looked long at Tantris, then nodded in satisfaction.
He says he thinks he and Roland can handle you if it gets bad again. He says it was mostly that Roland was caught off guard, that things got out of hand the first time.
She felt a heavy burden fall from her heart.
Good. And thanks.
He gave her a wink.
I'll get it out of you.
She made a face at him and curled up in the blankets to sleep with a much lighter heart. They woke at very close to their normal time. There would be no dallying today, nor for many days to come. Not if they wanted to reach the road before their supplies ran out. They suited up in their warmest clothes, took the shovels, and began the long task of cutting a path to freedom. The snow was wet and heavy, an advantage since it stayed on their shovels better. But the very weight of it made shoveling exhausting work. They took a break at noon for a hot meal and a change of clothing, as what they'd put on this morning was now quite soaked through. They shoveled until it was almost too dark to see.
"We've got to get to that tree and get it moved out of the way while the snow's still like it is now," Chris said over supper. "If it should turn colder and freeze, we'll never be able to get that thing moved. It would be stuck in ice like a cork in a bottle."
"We'll be all right as long as the snow keeps falling a little," Talia replied, thinking back to her days watching the Hold flocks at lambing time. "We'll only have to worry about the temperature falling if the weather changes."
They turned in early, hoping to get to the tree before the end of the next day. By late afternoon they had reached it, and decided, after looking the massive trunk over, that it would be best if they hacked it in half with their hand axes and hitched the Chiras and companions to the lighter half. When darkness fell, they were slightly more than halfway through the trunk. Again they rose with the sun and returned to the tree.
They managed to cut through it by noon, and after lunch made their attempt to move it. They had decided the previous night to leave nothing to chance, and had made a set of harnesses for themselves from spare rope. They hitched their own bodies right in beside the Churas and Roland and Tantris. It turned out that it was just as well that they had decided to do so. Only when all six of them dug in and strained with all their strength did it move at all. All of them gasped and panted with the effort, and overburdened muscles screamed out in protest while the tree shifted fraction by minute fraction. It took until dark to haul it clear of their escape route. As darkness fell, they dragged themselves back into the station, nearly weeping with aches and exhaustion. Nevertheless, they rubbed the churras dry and groomed their companions, fed and watered and blanketed them. Only then did they strip off their own sodden garments and collapse on their bed. They were too bone-weary to think of anything but lying down, and their aching bodies. Finally,
"Do you really want supper?"
Chris asked her dully. It was his turn to make it. The very idea of food was nauseating.
"No,"
she replied, in a voice fogged with exhaustion.
"Oh, good,"
he said with relief.
"Neither do I."
"I can't seem to get warm."
It took an effort to get the words out.
"Me either."
Chris sat up with a low moan.
"If you'll get the tea, I'll dig out the honey."
"It's a bargain."
They'd left hot water for tea on the hearth, knowing they'd want it. Neither of them rose any farther than their knees as they dragged themselves to their goals. Talia poured water onto the herbal mixture, spilling half of it as her hands shook with weariness. Chris returned with the jar of honey in one hand and something else in the other. He put the jar down with exaggerated care, and Talia spooned three generous dollops into each mug. Fortunately, it was too thick to spill as the water had. She pushed one mug toward Chris, who handed her something in exchange for it. It was one of the fruit and nut bars Carathan had forced into them back at Waymeet. Talia felt sick at the sight of it.
"I know,"
Chris said apologetically.
"I feel the same way, but if we don't eat something, we'll pay for it tomorrow."
She stirred the honey into her tea and drank it even though it was still so hot it almost scorched her tongue. As heat spread through her, the food began to seem a bit more appealing. As she finished the second mug of tea, she was actually feeling hungry. Chewing the tough, sticky thing took the last of her energy, though. From the look of things, Chris was feeling the same way. The third cup of tea settled the question entirely. She just barely managed to get underneath the blankets before she was asleep. She woke with every muscle screaming in angry protest. She shifted position a little, and a groan escaped.
"I wish I was dead. I wouldn't hurt so much,"
Chris moaned forlornly in her ear.
"Me too. But I keep thinking of what Albrecht always told us."
"Must you remind me? The cure that is best for the soul body is more of what made it sore. Oh, how I wish he was wrong."
"At least we have to go out long enough to see what we have to deal with beyond the tree."
"You're right."
Chris uncoiled himself, slowly and painfully.
"And we have to wrestle more wood inside."
"And more hay."
"And more hay, right. There's this much, little bird. If you feel like I feel, you couldn't project past your own nose right now."
They helped each other wash and dress. There were too many places they couldn't reach for themselves without their stiff muscles screaming at them. Talia managed to concoct porridge with fruit in it, making enough to feed them twice more, and tea as well. They would probably be so tired they wouldn't taste either, but it would be solid and warm, and hopefully they wouldn't be so tired tonight that the very thought of food was revolting. When they opened the door, the glare of the sunlight on all that snow drove them back, for the weather had changed overnight, and the sky was cloudless. Without some kind of protection for their eyes, they'd be snow-blind in moments.
"Now what?"
Talia asked, never having had to deal with this kind of situation before. Chris thought hard.
"Keep your eyes shadowed from above by your cloak hood, and I'll see if I can rig something for the snow glare."
He rummaged through his pack, emerging with a roll of the thin gauze they used for bandages. Wrap that around your head about twice. It should be thin enough to see through.
It wasn't easy to see through, but it was better than glaring light that brought tears to the eyes. The tree lay where they had left it, and beyond it was the pathway out. Somewhere. It was possible to see where it went by the lane between the trees and the absence of underbrush. The problem was that it lay beneath drifts that, from where they were standing, never seemed to be less than 4 feet deep.
"Well, at least there's no more downed trees," Talia said, trying to be cheerful.
Chris just sighed.
"Let's get the shovels."
The drifts were deep, but at least they were not as wide as the ones in their valley had been. Though the snow was seldom less than 2 feet deep, it also was rarely more than 6. They shoveled and trampled until dusk, then brought in more wood and fodder, ate, and fell into bed.
Talia woke in the middle of the night, feeling very cold. Puzzled, she huddled closer to Chris, who murmured sleepily but didn't wake. Despite this, she kept feeling colder. Eventually, she moved warily out of bed. As soon as she did so, the chill of the air struck her like a hammer blow. She slipped her feet into her sheepskin slippers, wrapped her cloak around herself, and quickly moved to pile wood on the fire. When the flames rose, she could see the eyes of the churras and companions blinking at her. They had moved out of their corner and nearer to the heat.
"Smata," Chris asked sleepily, "why is it so cold?"
"The weather changed again. The temperature's dropping," Talia said, thinking about how the wet snow outside must be freezing into drifts like outcroppings of white granite. "I think the Luck Goddess just left us."
Chapter 9. When at last they slept again, it was restlessly. They woke early and with a premonition of the worst. The icy chill of the station did not encourage dawdling. They dressed quickly and went out to discover just how bad the situation truly was. It wasn't good by any stretch of the imagination. The snow had frozen, thickly crusted on top, granular and hard underneath. The crust was capable of supporting their weight, and even the weight of the churras unladen, providing that they held their pace to a snail's crawl. But it would never hold the churras with even a small pack or the companions. And as if that weren't bad enough, it was obvious that their shovels were not sturdy enough to deal with snow this obdurate. Both heralds stared hopelessly at the rock-hard place where they'd left off digging the night before, and at the now useless shovels. Finally, Talia swore passionately, kicked at a lump of snow, and bit her lip to hold back tears of frustration, and reminded herself not to let anything leak.
"Look, Talia, we're not getting anywhere like this," Chris said after a long moment of silence. "You're tired. So am I. One day isn't going to make any difference to us one way or the other. For that matter, neither will two or three. I'm your counselor. Well, I counsel that we take a rest and let our bodies recover until we can think of a plan that has some chance of getting us out of here."
Talia agreed wearily. Once back inside, she lit the little oil lamp and surveyed the shambles they'd made of the interior of the station.
"We're obviously going to be here a while, so it's time we stop living in a goat pen. Look at this. We hardly have room to move."
Chris looked around and ruefully agreed. They began cleaning and rearranging with a vengeance. Working in the comparatively warm station was by far and away easier than shoveling snow had been. Before noon, the station was cleaned and swept, and all was in good order.
"Had any ideas?"
Chris ventured over lunch.
"Nothing that pertains to the problem. I did think of something that needs doing, though. Since we're stuck until we can think of a way to handle that snow, we ought to do something about washing our clothing. The only warm things that I have left to wear are what I've got on."
"There's saddle soap in the station supplies to clean the leathers," he said, thinking out loud. "And we could empty 2 of the barrels to wash in."
"I brought more than enough soap for all the rest," she told him. "And the Lord knows we don't have to scrimp on water."
"All right, then. We'll do it. I'm in no better shape than you, and I hate wearing filthy clothes."
Under the primitive conditions of the station, cleaning white clothing was not an easy chore. Again, however, it was easier than the digging and hauling they'd been doing, and a great deal warmer as well. Eventually, every clean surface
sported a drying garment.
I never thought I'd want to see another set of student greys again, Talia said, sitting back on her heels and surveying her handiwork.
I know what you mean,
Chris grinned, looking up from his last pair of boots.
At least the damn things didn't show dirt quite so badly. How are you doing?
I'm done, since I did my leathers while you were washing.
This finishes it for me.
Well, I still have hot water left, enough for two really good baths. It's too bad we can't fit ourselves into the barrels and soak, but at least we can get really clean.
Good thinking, little bird. Although, after all the soap and water I've been immersed in today, there isn't much that needs to soak.
Things began to take on a more cheerful appearance once they were clean, especially since they weren't aching from the punishing cold and muscle strain of the past few days. Talia combed her wet hair out in front of the fire, more than half mesmerized by the flickering flames and the movement of the comb through her hair. The station had lost the slightly stale odor it had acquired during the blizzard, and now smelled of soap and leather, very pleasant. Bits of old tales began to flicker through her mind, unconnected images dealing with tales of battle, of all things. Battles, and how the companions themselves used to fight alongside their heralds. Or were those images unconnected?
Chris, she said slowly, an idea beginning to form, the main problem is the hard snow and the ice crust. Our shovels aren't strong enough to break it into pieces. But if we wrapped our legs to keep them from being cut, Roland and Tantris could, like they were fighting.
By the stars of the lady, you're right, he exclaimed with excitement. Not only that, remember how you wondered what good those huge claws did the Chirrers? They dig themselves hollows to lie in dirt or in snow. If we could make them understand what we wanted, we could have them dig out chunks of a size we could manage.
Havens. Roland and Tantris can do that.
Tantris snorted, and Roland sent Talia a little mental caress. Chris laughed.
All right, Grantha,
he said to his companion, looking happier than he had all day. He turned back to Talia.
The source of all wisdom over there seems to think we'll be able to work faster than we did before. He wanted to know why we hadn't thought of this until now.
Well, you two wouldn't have done us much good with the wet snow now, would you?
Talia asked, the two sets of backward-pointing ears. Roland tossed his head.
And the Chirrers would have made more of a mess than they'd have cleared. The snowdrifts weren't stable enough until they froze,
Chris added, a little smugly.
So there.
Did he say anything else?
Talia asked, a little envious of Chris's ability to mind-speak with his companion.
He just told me he's been worried about how hard we've been working. But then he actually ordered me to rest tomorrow. You'd think we were trainees.
Talia shook her head ruefully, for there was no doubt that Roland considered this to be an excellent idea. There was a distinct undertone to his mental sending of worry that both of them had been overworking.
Roland says the same. I don't think I want to argue. Oh, Bright Havens, I hurt.
Talia stretched aching arms and shoulders.
This has hardly been the rest stop we were ordered to take.
Chris groaned good-naturedly, stretching his own weary muscles.
If anything, I'm more exhausted than I was when we stopped, if that's possible. I'm certainly a lot sorer.
Then I'll make you an offer. Want a back rub?
Do you?
Oh, Lord, yes, she sighed.
I'll work on you, then you work on me. Strip, wench. I can't work through four shirts and a tunic.
It's only two, she protested with a laugh. And there's summer weight at that. While I was cleaning, I wanted to clean everything.
Nevertheless, she complied, stretching out on a pallet of blankets on the hearth. Chris seemed to find every last ache and drove each one out with deft fingers. Soothed by the gentle hands, she drifted into a half-sleep. He woke her by tickling the back of her neck.
My turn,
he said as she lazily turned her head. She sighed with content and rose to her knees, and slipped on a shift, blessedly clean and warm from the fire, while he took her place on the hearth. She tried to copy what he'd done to her, and hunted for the muscles that were the most tense, and so hurt the most. Before very long she had him as soothed and relaxed as she was, and they basked in the heat of the fire, like a couple of contented cats.
"I'll do anything you ask," he murmured happily, anything, so long as you don't ask me to move, and as long as you don't stop.
She giggled at the tone of his voice as she gently rubbed his shoulders. All right, then. Tell me about Dirk.
Promise not to stop what you're doing.
Surely.
Good, he said with satisfaction. Because it's a very long story. For one thing, I have to start with his grandfather.
Oh, come now, she said, raising an eyebrow. Is this really necessary, or are you just trying to prolong the back rub?
I promise you, it's absolutely necessary. Now, once upon a time, when Dirk's grandfather settled his steading, he lived on the very border itself. He was quite ambitious, so he added a little more to his lands every year, and only stopped when he had as much as one man could reasonably expect to keep under cultivation with the aid of a moderate number of hands. By then the border had been pushed back by him and others like him. So, now that it was a safer place to live, he married.
Logical, seeing as he had to have produced at least one offspring to be Dirk's father.
Quiet, wench.
As it happened, their only child was female. But it didn't perturb him that he would be leaving the steading to her. He fully expected that she would marry in due course, and the place would still be in the bloodline. However, the gods had other ideas in mind.
Don't they always?
First of all, it turned out that his daughter had a really powerful gift of healing. Now, this was as welcome as it was unexpected, since it's hard to get healers to station themselves near the border. There's always more work there than they can handle successfully, unless they're stationed with a temple, and you know how healers are. They'd rather die than leave something half done. At any rate, border-bred healers always seem to feel they have a duty to serve where they were born, so there was little chance she'd end up anywhere else. Her proud and happy father sent her off to the Healers' Collegium, and in due course she returned in her greens. So far, everything had gone according to expectation. However, being the healer put a crimp in her father's original plans for her. It seemed that the young men of the area were somewhat reluctant to court a person whose attentions could, because of her gift, never be entirely devoted to any one person. And this, despite the tale I told you about them. Healers are, after all, healers first and anything else second.
Like heralds or priests, look at us.
Point taken. At any rate, not even the rather substantial inducement of her inheritance could lure any of the neighboring farmers or their sons to the nuptial table. The old man began to despair of having his hard-won acreage remain in the family. Then there came the second twist to the plot. Late one autumn night, there was a terrible storm.
I've had my fill of storms.
Hush, this is a required storm. In fact, it was the worst autumnal storm that part of the kingdom had ever seen. It began after sunset, and lightning downed so many trees that it was completely unnecessary to cut any for firewood that fall. Freezing rain fell from the heavens in sheets rather than drops. There was so much thunder that it was impossible to hold a conversation and impossible to sleep. And in the midst of all this chaos and confusion, there came a knocking on the farmstead door.
Chris was very obviously enjoying himself to the hilt.
A tall, dark, mysterious stranger, no doubt.
Who's telling this story, you or me? As a matter of actual fact, it was a stranger, half drowned, half frozen, half dead, and very much bedraggled, but blonde and hardly mysterious. It was a young bard, only recently graduated from his collegium and starting his journeyman period. He'd lost his way in the storm, fallen into a river, and had all manner of uncomfortable things happen to him. When he pounded on their door, he was already fevered, delirious, and well on his way to a full-blown case of pneumonia.
I smell a romance.
You have an accurate nose. Naturally, the young healer took him in and nursed him back to health. Just as naturally, they fell head over heels in love. Being a man of honor, as well as having his head stuffed full of all those romantic ballads, the bard begged the old man's permission to wed his daughter in true heroic style. He needn't have worried, because by now the old fellow was beginning to think that any son-in-law was better than none. However, he made it a condition of his agreement that they remain on the steading.
It rather surprised the old farmer when the, he thought, feckless, footloose bard agreed with all his heart, subject to the agreement of his circle, of course. How could the old man have known that our bard was born a farmer, and that entwined with his love of music and his love of the daughter was his love and deep understanding of the land? Well, the circle agreed, provided he compose a master's ballad about the storm, courtship and all, and he settled down happily with all three of his loves, land, lady, and music. Then, before the year was out, he had a fourth.
Dirk! So that's where he got that wonderful voice.
And where he learned to play so well. Actually, though, you're a bit ahead of the tale. The first child wasn't Dirk. He has three older sisters, two younger, and a baby brother. When they can be sorted into some semblance of order and organization, they have family concerts. You should hear them all singing together. It's wonderful. I swear, even the babies cry in the right keys. Well, Grandfather passed to his reward, content in the knowledge that the land would remain in the bloodline, since by the time he departed, two of the girls had begun enthusiastically producing enormous broods of their own.
I was asking about Dirk.
Talia, my little bird, you can't separate Dirk from his family. They're all alike. See one, you know what the rest are like. How things ever get done in that household, I have no idea, since it seems to be formed entirely of chaotic elements.
Just like a bard.
Actually, he's the most organized of the lot. If it weren't for him and the husbands of the sisters, they'd spend all their time flying in circles. There's an incredible amount of love there, though, and it overflows generously on anyone who happens to find himself dragged unwittingly into their midst.
Like you.
Like me. Dirk insisted on hauling me home with him the first holiday after we'd met, when he found out there wasn't going to be anyone home with me but the servitors. They treated me exactly like one of the family, from bathing babies to teary farewell kisses. I was rather overwhelmed. I certainly hadn't expected anything like them.
Talia chuckled, picturing to herself the reserved, slightly shy young boy that Chris must have been, finding himself in the hands of what must have seemed like a family of madmen.
Once I got used to them, I had a lot of fun. That's why, every chance I've had, I've gone home with Dirk when he went. Right now, four of his sisters are married. Three of them live in extensions to the original house, and their husbands share the work on the steading, because Dirk's father has developed bad knees. The last has his own land to look after, but they're still on hand for every holiday in the calendar. It's a good thing they all get along so well.
We were talking about Dirk.
Right.
Chris's eyes gleamed with mischief at the impatience in her voice.
He was chosen, even younger than I. Only 11. Probably because at 11 he was more mature in a lot of ways than I was at 13. We were chosen the same year and almost the same month. He told me that Aradi chose him in the middle of the marketplace on fair day, and he kept trying to direct her attention to his sister because he thought he was too ugly to be a herald.
Poor child.
So, we went through the collegium as year mates. He saw how lonely I was there and how unused to dealing with other children and decided that I needed a friend. And since I couldn't seem to make one by myself, he was going to do it for me. In classes, though, I had to help him along, and he was never better than average. It was pretty well accepted by all of us that after our internships, he was going to work border sectors and I was going to teach. Then we found out how our gifts dovetailed and how incredibly well we worked together, and everyone's plans were rather abruptly changed.
And you began working as a team?
Oh, yes. And we discovered that we have a kind of gift for intrigue as well. The number of situations we've gotten ourselves into would astound you, yet we always seem to extricate ourselves and come home covered in glory.
Chris, what's he really like?
Behind the jester mask? Very sensitive. That's his heritage coming out. Endlessly kind to the helpless. You should see him sometime with a lap full of kittens or babies. Don't think he's soft and sentimental, though. I've seen him slit people's throats in cold blood when they deserved it, and do it from behind in the dark without a pretext of fair play. He says that if they're intending to do the same to him, it doesn't make sense to give them warning. He can be totally ruthless in the cause of queen, kingdom, and circle. Let's see, what else is there? You've danced with him, so you know that his bumbling farmer look is totally deceiving. He's one of the few people that Albrecht will accept,
to act as a substitute with his advanced pupils when Albrecht is sick. And for all that, he's terribly vulnerable in certain areas. I helped him get over his broken heart, and I promise you, Talia, that I will personally break the neck of anyone who hurts him like that again."
He was lying with his head turned to one side and pillowed on his arms. Talia could not help but see the fierce, cold hatred in his expression at that moment. Chris's fierce tone as he spoke the last few words was completely unfeigned. He remembered only too well what Dirk had been like then, broken, defeated. It had been horrible to compare what that bitch had made him into with what he had been before she'd worked her wiles on him. Dirk seldom shed a tear, but he had wept helplessly on Chris's shoulder when she'd ruined his life and his hopes for him. It was a thing he never wanted to witness again, and if he had any say about it, he never would. Then a painful thought occurred to him. He knew Dirk was more than interested in Talia, and she had been showing evidence of the same sort of feeling. But he and Talia had most of a year to go on her internship, and now that they were intimate, it was damned unlikely they'd go back to their earlier relationship. What the hell was he going to do if she started getting infatuated with him? It was more than a possibility, after all. Nearly every other female he'd spent any time with had ended up in the same state. He didn't want to think about it.
"I think it's time to do something about your problem," he said, thinking that trouble might be less likely if he reasserted his position as a figure of authority.
"Like what?" She sat up slowly and shook her hair out of her eyes, her expression in the flickering firelight a sober one.
"I'm going to take you absolutely back to basics, back to the very first thing they taught me."
"Shielding?"
"Hell no, girl," he replied, astounded. "More basic than that. And if shielding was what they taught you first, maybe that's one reason why you're having this problem. I'm taking you right back to the first steps, ground and center."
She looked puzzled and shifted a little, curling her legs under her. "Ground and what?"
"Oh, gods," he groaned. "How the hell did you get away with—" "Of course. Ilsa must have thought you knew the basics. Maybe you did, instinctively."
He bit his lip, thinking hard, staring off into the space beyond his internee. Talia just sat quietly, peering anxiously at him through the half-dark of the station.
"Trouble is, as my teacher used to say, instinct is no substitute for conscious control."
I guess I've rather well proved that, haven't I?" she replied bitterly.
"Well, once instinct goes, there's no basis for reorganizing yourself."
He took a deep breath, acutely aware of the faint smell of soap, straw, and animal that pervaded the station.
"Gods,"
she sighed and rubbed her temple with one hand. "All right, do your worst."
"Don't laugh," he replied grimly. "Before I'm through, it may well seem like just that. All right. Are you comfortable? Absolutely comfortable?"
She frowned, shifted a little, then nodded. He settled himself, folding his own legs under him, shifting until the straw under his blanket moved to a more comfortable place.
"Close your eyes. You can't sort out what's coming in at you unless you can recognize what's you and what isn't. That's what my teacher used to call the shape inside your skin. Find the place inside you that feels the most stable and work out from there. Feel everything, then put what you felt away because you can recognize it as you."
He was using what he called teaching voice with her, a kind of soothing monotone. She'd gone quite naturally into a half-trance, fairly well relaxed. By unfocusing his eyes and depending on sight rather than vision, he could see every move she made by the shifting energy patterns within her. Sight was a good gift to have for this situation, maybe better than her own would have been. By looking, not looking, in a peculiar sort of way that made his eyes feel strained, he could see energy fields and fluxes. What he saw was difficult to describe. It was something like seeing multiple images or ghosts of Talia, each one haloed in a different color. When he looked at the ungifted,
or gifted but untrained, the images didn't quite mesh, and the edges were fuzzy and indistinct. In Talia's case, the edges were almost painfully sharp, and the images were given to flaring at unpredictable intervals, and they were so unconnected they almost seemed to belong to more than one person. If she could find her center, they would fuse into one. If she could ground, the flaring would stop. All right. Once you've found that stable place, there's a similar place outside of you, in the earth itself. When you feel that, connect yourself to it. Finding the stable place is called centering. Connecting yourself to the earth is called grounding. He could tell, although his own gift wasn't anything like hers, that she had almost managed both actions. Almost, but not quite. The images were overlapping, but not fusing, and they dimmed and brightened and dimmed again. He could see that she was off balance and not connected, although to her it probably seemed as if she'd done exactly as he asked. Poor lady. He was about to do a very cruel thing to her. He sighed and signaled Tantris, who gave her a rude mental shove. A shove that translated into a very physical toppling over. "Not good enough," he said coldly, as she stared up at him from where she was sprawled, with a dazed expression on her face. "If you'd done the thing properly, he wouldn't have been able to budge you. Again, ground and center." She tried, much shaken this time. If anything, she was worse off than before. Tantris hardly flicked her, and she lost internal balance. This time she did not lose physical control, although it was a near thing. She visibly swayed, as if beneath a blow. "Ground and center, girl. This is a baby lesson. It ought to be reflex. Reflex, not instinct. Do it again." She was exhausted, sweat-drenched, knotted up all over, and shaking with the effort of holding back tears before he let up on her. There had been progress, though, and he told her so. "You're not there yet," he said, "but you're closer. You got a little closer to your true center each time you tried for it, except for the last time you missed it altogether. That's why we're quitting for a little." She buried her face in her hands, trembling all over. "I think," she said after a moment, her voice muffled, "that I could come to hate you with very little effort." "So why don't you?" he asked, masking his apprehension and the cold chill he felt at her words. She looked up at him and lowered her hands away from her face slowly. "Because you're trying to help me, and this is the only way you know how." He let out the breath he'd been holding in a long sigh of relief. "Lord of Lights," he said thankfully. "You would not believe how glad I am to hear you say that."
"Because if I did hate you, I could quite easily kill you."
"Exactly so. And all the easier while I was working with you, because I have to be completely unshielded to see what you're doing." She shuddered, and he moved forward to put his arms around her. She tensed for a moment, then relaxed into his shoulder.
"How much more of this?"
"Until you get it right."
"Gods, and this is only the very beginning?"
"Just the first steps."
She bit back a sob of frustration. He felt it more than heard it, and ached for her. And said the cruelest thing yet.
"All right, you've had your wallow in self-pity. Now let's get back to work."
And when she stared at him in disbelief, he snapped an order at her like any drill instructor.
"Ground and center, girl. Ground and center."
When he finally let up on her, it was so late that he'd had to mend the fire twice. She was physically as well as emotionally drained. She crawled into bed and huddled among the blankets, too spent even to cry. He was almost as exhausted as she. He staggered over to the fire and banked it with painful precision, controlling the shaking of his hands with effort.
"You almost had it," he said finally. "You came so close. I think you might have had it, if you'd just had the energy to get there."
She lost the bleak emptiness that had been in her eyes.
I thought maybe..."
"Tomorrow we'll try something different. We'll try it in Link. Once you find your center, you won't lose it again. Gods, it is so frustrating watching you. I can see you coming close and missing, and I want to scream."
"Well, it's no festival from inside either," she retorted,
then managed a wan smile. The least you can do after torturing me all night is to get in with me and keep me warm.
Oh, I think I could manage something more personal than that,
he replied, dredging up a smile of his own. Talia fell asleep almost immediately, every last bit of energy exhausted by the efforts of the day. Chris remained awake a bit longer, trying to figure how he was going to fit in the training with the all-too-necessary effort of digging out. Just before he finally slept, Tantris had the last word.
"Not one day," Tantris ordered. "You're more tired than you thought. You rest tomorrow, too."
"I'm fine," Chris objected in a whisper.
"Huh! You only think you are. Wait until tomorrow. Besides, if you can get her centered, you'll be on the way to solving that problem. That takes precedence, I think."
"I hate to admit it,"
Chris yawned.
"But you're right, Featherfoot."
Chris had not realized how truly bone-weary they were until he woke first the next day to discover that it was well past noon. He woke Talia, and they finished mending all the now dry garments, putting off the inevitable lesson as long as possible by mutual unspoken accord. Finally, it was she who said reluctantly,
"I suppose we'd better."
"Unfortunate, but true. Here."
He sat on the blankets of their bed and patted a place in front of him.
"I told you I was going to try a different tactic. You've linked in with me before, so you know what it's like."
She seated herself cross-legged, their knees touching, and looked at him warily.
"I think I'd remember. Why?"
"I'm going to try and show you your center. Now, just relax, and let me do the work this time."
He waited until she had achieved that half-trance, closed his own eyes long enough to trance down himself, then rested his hands lightly on her wrists. It was little more than a moment's work to bring her into rapport. That part of her gift was still working, almost too well. He opened his eyes slowly and looked, knowing she could see what he saw. She looked, gasped, and grabbed, throwing both of them out of trance and out of rapport. He had been expecting something of the sort and had been prepared for a fall. She had not been, and sat shaking her head to clear it afterward.
"That was a damn fool move," she said, when at last she could speak. "I won't argue with that statement," he replied evenly. "Ready to try again?"
She sighed, nodded, and settled herself once more. This time, she did not grab. She hardly moved at all. Finally, she broke the trance herself, unable to take the strain.
"It's like trying to draw by watching a mirror," she said through clenched teeth.
"So?"
he replied, giving her no encouragement to pity herself.
"So I try again."
It was hours later when she met with victory. As Chris had suspected, when she centered properly, it was with a nearly audible snap, a great deal like having a dislocated joint pop back into place. There was a flare of energy and a flash of something almost like pain, followed by a flood of relief. Chris had Tantris nudge her, then shove her, with no effect.
"Ground!"
he ordered. She fumbled her way into a clumsy grounding with such an utter lack of finesse that his other suspicion, that she'd never done grounding and centering properly before, was pretty much confirmed. It was then that he realized that her shields hadn't just gone erratic. They'd collapsed. And the reason they'd collapsed was that they'd never been properly based in the first place.
"All right,"
he said quietly.
"Now you're properly set up. Can you see now why it's important?"
"Because," she answered slowly, "you have to have something to use as a base to build on."
"Right," he agreed. "Now, come out of there."
"But..."
"You're going to find it yourself this time, without my help. Ground and center, Greenie." "Ground and center, damn it, that's not right. Do it again. Ground and center, again, and faster. Damn it, it should be reflex by now, again."
Talia held to her temper, by the most tenuous of holds. If it hadn't been for the concern he was feeling, so overwhelming that she could sense it with no effort at all, she'd have lost her temper hours ago. Ground and center, over and over, faster and faster, with Tantris and Roland shoving at her when she least expected it.
The first time they'd pushed her before she was properly settled, she'd literally been knocked out for a moment. She came to with Chris propping her up, expression impassive.
"Tantris hit me,"
she said indignantly.
"He was supposed to," Chris replied, letting her go.
"But I wasn't ready. It wasn't fair."
She stared at him, losing the tenuous hold she'd had on her emotions. It felt like betrayal. It felt horribly like betrayal.
"Damn right it wasn't fair."
He answered the anger and hurt in her voice with cool contempt.
"Life isn't fair. You learned that a long time ago."
He felt the anger then. Hers. It couldn't be coming from anywhere else, since beneath his veneer of contempt, he was worried and no little frightened. He was taking his life in his hands by provoking her, and was all too conscious of the fact.
"Damn it, you're leaking again. Lock it down."
The anger died. She flushed with shame. He didn't give her a chance to get back into the cycle of doubt and self-pity.
"Now, ground and center, and get centered before they can knock you over."
He didn't even let her stop when they ate, snapping at her to center at unexpected moments, letting Tantris or Roland judge when she was most off guard and choosing then to push at her. It wasn't until he was exhausted, so exhausted he couldn't properly see anymore, that he called it quits for the night. She undressed for bed in total silence, so barricaded that there was nothing to read in her face or eyes. He waited for her to say something. Waited in vain.
"I'm not sorry," he said finally. "I know it's not your fault. You got out of Grey's half-trained, but I'm not sorry I'm doing this to you. If you don't learn this the hard way, you won't learn it right."
"I know that," she replied, looking up at him sharply. "And I'm not angry at you. Not now, anyway. I'm mostly tired and gods, my head hurts, so I can hardly think."
He relaxed and reached for the container of willow bark on the mantelpiece, handing it to her with a rueful smile.
"In that case, I can assume it's safe to come to bed?"
"I wouldn't murder you there, anyway,"
she replied with a hint of her old sense of humor. "It would get the blankets all sticky." He laughed and settled himself, watching her make herself a cup of herbal tea for her headache. Before today, he hadn't been sure. But now, he dared to believe she would tame that wild gift of hers. It wouldn't be too much longer before centering would be reflex. Then it was only a matter of time to build back what she'd lost.
"Chris, are you still awake?"
"Sort of,"
he answered drowsily, lulled by the warmth and his own weariness.
"I just want to say that I appreciate this. At least, I do when you're not pounding on me."
He chuckled, but made no other reply.
"I need you, Chris," she finished softly. "That's something I don't forget, even when I'm angriest. I really need you."
It took a while for the sense of that to penetrate. And when it did, it almost shocked him awake again, if he hadn't been so tired. As it was, guilt followed him down into sleep. She needed him. Good gods, what if it was something more than need? Talia waited until Chris's deep and even breathing told her he really had fallen asleep, and carefully extricated herself from the bed without waking him. She always thought better with some task in her hands, a holdover from her childhood, so she took her cup of willow bark tea and set about polishing some of the bright bits of metalwork on Roland's tack. The cloak she'd wrapped around herself kept the chill off her back, and the fire in front of her gave off just enough heat to be pleasant. Thusly settled in, she put her mind to the myriad problems at hand. The fire crackled cheerfully. She wished she could feel cheerful. Lord and lady, what an unholy mess she'd gotten into. The storm alone would have been bad enough. Any of the problems would have been bad enough to have to deal with all of them together. At least she'd made a start, some kind of start, on getting herself retrained. Chris seemed happier after this afternoon's work. He had been right about one thing. Now that she knew what being centered felt like, she'd never lose the ability to find that firm base again. She'd wanted to kill him this afternoon, and more than once. But she was learning in a way that would make her stronger, and now that she was calmer, she could appreciate that. She needed him, more than she'd ever needed anyone else. But Lord and Lady, what if it was something more complicated than need, or even need and the kind of feeling she had for Skiff? He was handsome, handsome as an angel, and despite a certain smug vanity, a man she'd be more than proud to have as a friend.